It was about a year ago, in May, actually, of 2011, that very few people noticed when a woman just shy of her 105th birthday died in New York City. Although she was extremely wealthy, owned three luxury properties, New York, California, and Connecticut, she spent the last 22 years of her life in a small room at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. She wasn't sick. Why would someone who wasn't really sick spend two decades in a hospital? And why had she lived as a recluse since 1930? Huguette Clark's father made his millions in Montana mining, somewhat disreputably, I might add, and she inherited his fortune and his properties. She kept her houses staffed and ready all the time, but none of her employees, with the exception of a couple, had ever met her because she never visited them. She never went to the 22,000 square foot mansion that overlooked the ocean in Santa Barbara. She didn't go to her country estate near New Canaan, Connecticut. And it had been decades since she had lived in her apartment overlooking Central Park. And when she did live there, only one friend was allowed to visit. Before she died, this friend was asked by an interviewer why someone who could have had every advantage, who could have done so much good in the world with what she had been given, lived in a small room in a hospital for over 20 years. Her friend said, well, she didn't trust people. She thought they were after her money. She was afraid of getting sick, so she moved into a hospital in kind of a strange way to ward off illness. At the end of her life, there was no one else, not one person who came to see her. Huguette Clark lived a long life, almost 105 years, but not a full one. She had lived out of fear, and that fear caused her to cut off almost all human contact, and it robbed her of what her life could have been, of all that had been given to her. That's easy kind of to sit back and say, well, I would never do that. I probably said that on first hearing about her life. But it's all too easy to be overtaken by fear, isn't it? Really. It doesn't take much. At first, it's just the idea of something or the threat of something or just something that pops into our head in a moment in the night when we wake up at 2:30. And that notion can grow until we're choked. We become wrapped up, consumed with the possibility of catastrophe. Now, sometimes there really are things in the dark, because there are real monsters out there over which we have no control. And so fear moves in. Fear can just move in and take over our lives. When the risen Christ comes to visit his disciples the first time after the resurrection, he has to deal with their fear. They are afraid. And it's the substance of his greeting. What does he say? He says, peace be with you. We read that in John and Luke. And as we've been walking together in these days since Easter, worshiping each Sunday and hearing these readings and meditating on them, we realize that we've heard this before in the weeks preceding, how the time between the resurrection and Pentecost is a journey for the disciples. They've got a lot of ground to make up. It's a journey for them out of doubt. It's a journey out of confusion, out of fear. The risen Lord stands in their midst and calls them to believe, to follow him, and to move out of fear to love. What does he ask Peter? It's actually a reading we won't have this year, but when he encounters Peter on the beach, what does he ask Peter? He says, do you love me? See, love becomes the defining feature of discipleship for those who desire to claim the name of Christ. because it's love that defined Jesus' life and sacrifice. It was only love that could compel him. Only love that would have the Father send the Son. Only love that could cause Jesus to give up his life for us. And it's the mark of the community that takes the name of Christ. Do we love or do we fear? The love that Jesus shows, the love that John writes about, is not a sentimental love. It's not a fuzzy love. I mean, a lot of people quote from that passage we heard today from 1 John, don't they, about God is love. And often they quote it and, you know, it can be used in a way of sort of appealing to license. God's love, God, you know, it's okay, don't worry, it's be happy, whatever. I don't think that's the context for that. The love is Calvary love. It's a sacrificial, surrendering love. It's a costly love. And it's this love that we're to receive and to show to others. You know, it's interesting that John, the writer, talks so much about love, more than any of the other gospel writers, and I think really more than any other New Testament author, too. It's a major theme of John's. And in these weeks, we have passages from both the Gospel of John and the letters, particularly 1 John. And there are ways they speak to each other. There's a kind of conversation going on between the gospel and the epistle. That's not a coincidence. These writings share a common history. They share a common authorship, although there are always people who want to challenge things like that. I think that's sort of what drives PhDs, dissertation topics, sometimes. But there is no reason to cast out John as the author. His letters and his gospel come out of his life with Jesus, and also the life that he led after the resurrection. You know, sometimes we don't remember this, but John was a pastor as well as the beloved apostle. And so he's writing out of his experience in the church. His teaching on love isn't floating up here. It's rooted right here. Early tradition tells us that John planted and pastored churches in Ephesus, around Ephesus. And he was a leading figure that many church leaders would seek out for mentoring. They would go to him. They would learn from him. We have a testimony that Polycarp actually sat at the feet of John, one to learn from who this great apostle was, but also to hear the stories of Jesus firsthand. John was a pastor of churches. So his letters and his gospel come out of his experience with the people of God. He's not locked away in a room writing something that's you know, disembodied in some way. It's very much part of his experience. And it comes through what his churches are going through. And in his case, it was tough. It was very tough going. How do we know that? We'll just read 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. Probably a packet of letters all sent at the same time for these churches. There were divisions, terrible divisions in his churches. There were those that left and sought to lure others away, to turn people against John. There were false teachers, those who came in and said, Jesus isn't divine, and it really doesn't matter how you live. See, this was opposition inside the church, not from outside the church, as we expect that, and we see that over and over again in the New Testament. This was an internal opposition, an internal struggle, a conflict at the very heart of these churches. It was a mess with chaos and conflict, and guess what? He was the pastor. You know, it's interesting because there are some really famous churches from the first century. The church in Antioch became a megachurch. It was large, it was influential, it was wealthy. It sent out missionaries and provided key leadership to the Christian world for 600 years. But not John's churches. They split. They got smaller. They were rocked by conflict, and over time, they disappeared. No great heritage, no great fame. And today, in our world, we might ask, well, was John a successful pastor? Why couldn't the one who leaned on Jesus at the Last Supper, who was given Jesus' own mother to care for, who was the beloved disciple, why couldn't he know more success in pastoral ministry? What was he doing wrong, we say? Well, it's because God doesn't measure success the way we do. Out of that conflict of faithfully leading, of faithfully teaching, of sticking with and sticking through this troubled people in a troubled time, we have the writings that emerge. One scholar has suggested that if it weren't for the conflict in John's community, in his churches, where there were people saying, Jesus is not really divine, if it weren't for that, perhaps we would not have the most lofty and soaring statement of Christian identity: in the beginning was the Word. See, there is a legacy out of John's ministry. It's just not one we can count. So I think we read John with an echo of his churches. It's not everything, I understand that. I don't want to make more of it than it should be, but I think it's there. And we know that when he talks about love, especially love in the church, he's talking about something very real and gritty, something that he's had to deal with and something that he's sweated over and gotten down in the trenches with. So we're going to look at that this morning. That was just sort of leading up to some understanding of where this writing is coming from and how we might embrace it. We're in 1 John primarily. And the wonderful first truth that comes to us in these first verses is that God is the source of our love. Have you ever been told to do something or needed to do something that was beyond your ability? I'm sure you have. We all know that experience, right? It's very frustrating. It can be very frightening. Oh man, I don't know if I can do that. But see, we're moving beyond fear today, and we can only do what God has called us to do if God is the source of it. We can't do it in our own power. In fact, I think there are sometimes that God puts us in a place of knowing our limitations, of knowing our powerlessness, in order to get us to claim his power and his love and his identity. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. John doesn't try to strong-arm his readers into compliance. This isn't, he's not sort of pressuring them at all. He's inviting them to be who they really are made to be in Christ, by helping them to realize they do not have to generate this love on their own. John, I don't feel very loving today. It's okay. It's the love of God that compels, that constrains, that leads, that invites, that empowers. See, we're inspired by God's own love. We look at the sacrifice of Calvary, the sacrifice of the incarnation, a love that holds nothing back, and we're invited to imitate Christ. And we can live out of that divine love because we are his. We are born of God into new life. And this is what new life will look like, that we will love one another. It's a marker. It's a family resemblance. I actually love meeting family members of you all here. when they've come to visit and see the connections and see the resemblances. Maybe it's parents or grandparents, maybe it's children or grandchildren. And usually there is that resemblance somewhere, even if it's just something this kind of subtle. I smile about that. So it is to be with us. We are to look something like God. Well, how can we? Well, it's through God's love in us. If we don't show love, then we probably don't really know God. And that's a hard statement. But it isn't something we work up or conjure up or guilt trip. It's a gift to us that we receive by stepping up to it, by receiving and walking in it. We have a part to play, but the source of love has already been secured. I saw this in action when I was a teenager, and it's something that has stuck in my mind, and it fits this example very well. Our church was entering a revival. Now, I don't know if churches still do this. I think in smaller communities they do, but you know, they put a sign out front and say, revival starting Monday night. You know, revival's going to run the next 3-4 nights. I was like, well, I'm glad they know. And so we did that. We had invited a special guest speaker and, you know, to come. And it's actually twins from Canada. I know Miriam knows them. And so we thought, oh, we'll have a revival. Well, we did. And I'll tell you partly how it began. Two elderly men in the church. I knew them both. They're good men. But for some reason, and I'm not even sure they remembered the reason, they had had a 40-year feud. They did not speak. They sat on opposite sides of the church. They didn't pass each other. But it was their church. They weren't going anywhere, you know. They just continued, and their families continued to grow and sit on opposite sides of the church. And near the beginning of that time together, and I'm like 15 years old, and I watched one of those men cross the aisle and go to the other one, say, John, I forgive you. And the other man turned and he looked and he said, I forgive you. And they embraced. And I know that because one of them was my grandfather. See, they had no ability to do this. They could not. This was beyond their ability to do. Something had happened. I don't know what it was. They probably didn't know anymore. But it was God's love poured out in them that when they stepped into it and said, okay, I'm going to take a risk, that God met them and led them. And you know what? That actually helped to begin a revival in our church that went 10 weeks and transformed our whole community. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, Christian community is not an ideal which we must realize. It's rather a reality created by God in Christ in which we may participate. See, it's the love of Christ that compels us from 2 Corinthians 5. God's love is the prime action. God moves first. Then he says, okay, your move. And I'm going to help you. God is the source of love in our community. Secondly, love must become the way of life. As we move on from verse 11 on, you know, something remarkable happens when we receive the love of God and we begin to share it. And that is, God takes up residence in us. And then this love is made complete and whole. That's what verse 12 says. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is made complete in us. That's a beautiful idea, and it's even more beautiful as it happens. The Holy Spirit helps this to come about, and we have the assurance of this through the Spirit. If we obey God in love, we live in him, and God lives in us. Love becomes the way of life, not just an occasional visitor. This sounds really similar to me to Jesus' words in the gospel. Remain in me as I also remain in you. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Our spiritual vitality in God is tied to our remaining or our abiding in him. Living in love, as John would put it in the epistle. See, this is a deep and long-term commitment, and it has to do with resting. Abiding, remaining, resting. There's a common phrase in parts of Africa, I think it's sort of how they translate into English. When you go somewhere and they pick you up at the airport and they might ask you, where are you resting? That means, where are you going to stay? Where are you resting? It implies a place of submission, a place of surrender, where the struggle's done. You're going to set it aside for a time. It's not a situation where we give it a shot and see what happens, but a commitment that transcends conflict and uncertainty. Jesus says, remain in me. John says that we are to remain in love and community. That's the way we know the love and the life of God, and our fruitfulness is tied to this. G.K. Chesterton reflected that love is not blind. That's the last thing that it is. Love is bound. And the more it is bound, the less it is blind. Love is bound. We are bound to love. We're tied to it. We must remain. We must remain. Commitment is part of learning and walking in the life of love in God. It really is. I think it's certainly true in our Christian life. It's also true in community, in the church. Jesus is speaking of kind of the big picture. John is speaking of a more particular place. It's the place he's pastoring, is what he's speaking to those in his own congregations. What is the commitment that we make to the Lord first and then to each other? Is it conditional? I'm going to tell a story on Otto this morning. It's a little unfair because he's not here. He has a business conference he's at today. But I don't know if you know this young man, you need to get to know him. He's a remarkable young man. He's involved in leadership at his family's manufacturing business in Glenview. And he was looking for a church, a place to be, to really be rooted. And I know he met with me, and we had some time over coffee. I think he might have met with other people. He came to worship. And then he began to be a part of our church. And then he did something that was amazing. Maybe he was 25 at the time. I don't know. But he bought a townhouse in Deerfield so that he could be near this worship place. I remember we were talking one day over coffee at the Starbucks here in Deerfield, and we were talking just about things, and this is very early on in our relationship and his time with the church, and he kind of interrupted me. He said, look, he said, I'm not just, picking your brain. You're stuck with me. I am here, he said, for 60 years. If the Lord gives that. He said, I'm remaining. I'm abiding in the Lord and also abiding in the community. It really was convicting to me. It really was. David Brooks wrote an article, I think it's an article about people who grew up to be musicians. And the ones who do the best, the ones who are the most gifted musicians, and the ones who really build a career out of professional music, they did a study of what goes into that. What's the most important thing? It's not musicality. It's not a good ear, although obviously that's really important. It's not the encouragement of the family, although you need that. What they found was it's those children that pick up their instrument and say, I'm a musician. And that's it, it's over. See, Jesus is saying, remain in me. Pick up your identity and say, I'm the Lord's. Love becomes the way of life. And then thirdly, there are results to love. When we move into this, when we claim it, when we commit to the Lord and to each other, there are results. And they're good. It's good news. One thing John says, that in the world we are like Jesus. That's another daunting thought. But again, the source of that reality is God living through us. See, we don't have to be afraid of that. Because perfect love, God's love, drives out fear. And not only that, we express God's love in how we treat one another. John's a little repetitive. I don't know if you've noticed that or not. But that's important. He's coming at it in different ways and underlining different words. He's saying, pay attention. This is really critical. Live in love. You cannot hate a brother and sister and live in God's love. It's a fundamental contradiction. It's a verse my dad used to quote at us a lot with my three brothers. See, how we treat each other, how we talk to each other, how we talk about each other is of eternal consequence. It really matters. It's important to God. It's important to us. And this is where God's love, the love that compelled Jesus to the cross for our sake, the love that raised him from the dead in resurrection power, the love that now lives in us in the church and that constitutes our life together, this is where that love is seen in how we love one another. They'll know your mind, Jesus says, by your love. It means sometimes, I'm speaking about myself here, it means sometimes we have to grow up. We have to grow in maturity and set aside ways of doing things in order to be mature in the Lord, to grow in love one to another. We choose it, and God enables. Fear is driven out, and we're able to be in harmony, in have a peaceable kingdom, in a sense, of God's people. I love the picture of that, and I think this is the point in the sermon that you write and that I write. It's kind of an unfinished symphony. We finish it out together. What will that look like? What will our love among the brothers and the sisters really look like? How will we grow in it? What does it mean? You see, our faithfulness and our fruitfulness is this. Those who love God must also love one another. I can say I love you, but it really won't be tested till I have to prove it. And God will give us opportunities to prove that one to another. Thanks be to God. Amen.